You're off. So, hello and welcome to this podcast with me, Chris Hull, talking with author Harriet Tuckey. I work for Outside Limited, an outdoor clothing and equipment shop in Hathersage. And I'm their book buyer and organiser of lectures and book launches, of which I've done in the region of 50 book launches. Harriet is here at the Bamford Institute, taking part in a British Mountain Medicine Society Science Day organised by local doctor Jeremy Windsor. She is introducing a session in a short while about the 1960-61 Silver Hut expedition, which studied the physiology of acclimatisation at high altitude in the Himalaya. Harriet is neither a doctor nor a physiologist, but her father was, and her father was Dr. Griffith Pugh, who was the scientific leader of this expedition, working with the climbing leader Edmund Hillary, the well-known New Zealander who first ascended Everest with Tenzing Norgay in 1953. In 2013, Harriet wrote a biography of her father, the multi-award-winning Everest, The First Ascent, the untold story of Griffith Pugh, the man who made it possible. So, here we are. And the first question is, you know, what made your book so intriguing was that you didn't really get to know your father until after his death. So perhaps you could tell us why this was the case.
Well, my father was a rather distant, quite cross parent. And when I was young, he was mostly away on expeditions. And he wasn't really terribly interested in his children.
Right.
And I think I grew to be quite resentful of that. And I'd never asked him a question. I knew nothing about him. I really didn't. And I used to sort of keep him out of my mind, because I was offended by not knowing him and him not being a nice father.
Sure.
And so the reason that I wrote the book was that I was asked by my mother one day to help her at the Royal Geographical Society, where there was going to be a Royal Gala lecture celebrating the 40th anniversary of the first ascent of Everest. And I went along to help with his wheelchair. And in the middle of the lecture, a man stood up where there'd been a lot of talk about the brilliant leadership and the marvellous organisation. The Queen was there, and it was a glittering occasion. And then this man got up and absolutely stunned the room by saying he'd been hearing an awful lot about the brilliant leadership, the marvellous organisation, the wonderful climbers, but there'd been expeditions to Everest before with brilliant climbers and marvellous organisation. And they'd all failed, 11 of them in fact, but 7 major British expeditions. And what he was going to talk about was the main reason why the 1953 expedition succeeded where all its predecessors failed, and that was the work of the unsung hero of Everest. And the whole room went quiet, and it was just obviously very controversial.
That was Michael Ward, was it?
He was called Dr. Michael Ward, but I'd never seen him before.
Right.
And then he said my father's name, and I was sitting at the back, and I was just quite stunned by this.
Right.
And then as he began to outline all the scientific innovations which he said had been crucial to the expedition's success, I was just amazed. I didn't know about them.
Right.
So after that, I went away and I read John Hunt's book on the ascent of Everest. And none of the things that were mentioned during the lecture were in the book. And I realised that nobody could have known about them.
Yeah.
But my father's work was described by him in the 7th appendix, right at the very back, where only specialists would look. And I found this quite puzzling, but I didn't do anything about it for 10 years, because I didn't really want to. He died 18 months later.
Right.
I didn't want to think about him.
Sure.
I didn't do anything. And then the 50th anniversary came, and there was a wonderful Everest film made by the BBC, which didn't even mention his name, and I realised he's being forgotten. And if he really did make such a big contribution, it should be known about, and I must write about it. And so I did, really for the sake of my family, but also because it was clear that science did play a big role in the Everest success, and I thought people should know about it.
So what was the level of your contact with your father between the time that I think you ran away at 16, was it?
I left school at 16.
Yeah.
And I lived in London with an aunt. I left home altogether. Yes.
So your level of contact with your father between then and when you...
To go home at weekends sometimes. And then what would happen, like once, which I described in the introduction to my book, I parked my car in the wrong place in the driveway outside our house.
Oh, dear.
And he was... I hadn't failed to apologise for the transgression. And so he ordered me out, you know, get out of my house and never come back. And I knew perfectly well I could go back in an hour or two and he would have forgotten about it. And I did go back and it was fine, but you don't forget those things.
Sure.
So we hardly spoke.
Okay.
And I didn't know anything about his work. When I started to study his work, I was amazed by how little I knew about him as a scientist or as a person.
Okay, so as an academic yourself, did you enjoy...
I'm not an academic.
Perhaps.
I've done up to MA. I've done an MA, but I'm not really an academic.
Did you enjoy the research
Absolutely
process?
Loved it. Yeah. It was the thrill of the chase.
Oh, right.
I found all these things out, which people had never... Well, if they knew about them, they hadn't mentioned them. The archives were just full of wonderful stories, absolutely fascinating, how his work had really been... Well, really, John Hunt had managed to just keep it quiet.
Right.
Telling people, you don't need to bother about the science. You know, of course the science... It plays a role, but it's man that climbs the mountain, not the science, and so on. So he just avoided anyone finding out about it, really, or any emphasis being put on it.
Sure. And where did your research take you to?
I started with Michael Ward.
Right.
And
that's a good start.
He was absolutely passionate that the science hadn't been recognised. Right. So he wasn't too sure. He thought I was really the right person to write a biography, being a housewife and not a doctor or a... And then I went to someone called John West, who's a very eminent a respiratory physiologist, head of department, very eminent man altogether.
Yeah.
And I was sort of amazed that people like him, who it's quite difficult to see, was willing to spend lots of time talking about my father and telling me. And it soon came to a stage where there was this terrible weight of having to write this thing when I'd never written a book, and having to write something so difficult and so complicated on the one hand, but then on the other, all these fantastic people had been so kind to me that I couldn't let them down by not in the end doing it. So I did it.
Did you manage to get a publisher before or after?
No. There was only a 1% chance of finding a publisher. And it was just luck again. It was luck. I just sat next to a literary agent at dinner, and I told the story in a lot more detail than I told you of how I found out about my father's work on Everest. And just as I'd been telling you, and he said, oh, send me a chapter.
Right.
And then I sent him a chapter and he said, oh, I like that. Send me the book. And I sent him the book and he did nothing for 6 months. And then he sent it back and said, this is far too long, I can't possibly read it. And anyway, after that, I realised how I'd got to change it, and I entered it for something called the Biographers Club Prize for non-commissioned biographies for people like me.
Mm-hmm.
And there I realised you've got to tell a story, and I rewrote it for about the third time.
Right.
And it won the prize, and because it won the prize, I could then find a literary agent, and eventually the original literary agent represented me.
Right, good. So what was it that what was so special about what your father did in 1953? What was his real main achievements of that? What were the specific items that he was able to focus on?
Well, nobody had really managed to climb above 8,000 metres. They just, as though there was a glass ceiling.
Right.
So they could get up there, but they couldn't do the last bit. And the reason they couldn't do it was because although they'd had oxygen on every expedition since 1921, and there'd been 7 major expeditions, and they'd had it on all the expeditions, but they used it, it had been developed from high altitude flying, and they used it in the same way as pilots, which is to say they breathe 2 to 2.5 litres a minute of oxygen, and of supplementary oxygen. And whereas pilots are sitting in their cockpits, climbers are taking huge amount of exercise and carrying the sets. The pilots are not carrying anything. Mm-hmm. So climbers said it doesn't work, and it's so heavy, and it uses up energy, and they get no benefit. And so they kept saying it wasn't of any benefit, and they didn't take it seriously. And he said, well, it's quite obvious you're not using enough. And in all the British expeditions to Everest between the wars, they had been able to stop any other country going to Everest and competing with them. But after the war, they couldn't do that anymore, after they'd lost India, because it was having India that enabled them to stop other countries going to Everest, stop them getting permission. And the Swiss were given permission to go to Everest in 1952, and the British were horrified and could hardly believe it. And they said, damn it, it's our mountain. And they were given one more opportunity in 53, so they called in a physiologist to help them understand why climbers were never getting above, couldn't climb the last 1,000 feet. And they sent a practice expedition to Cho Oyu to train British climbers for their attempt on Everest the following, and they sent him to study the altitude problems. And so oxygen was the first thing. He studied the oxygen, realised they hadn't used enough, and doubled the rate at which they used it. Then they had never acclimatised properly. They didn't understand. They knew they'd got to acclimatise, but not how. And he devised an acclimatisation regime, which is still followed pretty much today. And then they didn't understand about drinking.
Right.
And he told them he did experiments on dehydration. And he said they had to drink 3 to 4 litres of water.
And how willing were they to take on this advice, the climbers themselves?
Well, they weren't keen on the oxygen at all, but they were very violently against mixing science and mountaineering. Sure. But because the way that the Everest expedition was organised was that there was a group of scientists who had always advised Everest expeditions, but they'd never taken any notice of them.
Yeah.
And these scientists said, we will not help you this time unless we have a high altitude committee which controls the oxygen and also other policies relating to the altitude. So his policies for oxygen, for acclimatisation, he designed the diet, clothing and protective equipment, he designed or modified that. He, almost every aspect of the expedition, other than the climbing side of it, was very heavily influenced by him. And he contributed in all those areas.
Now, in your book, I have to ask this question. In your book, you were reasonably critical of mountaineering icons of John Hunt, Ed Hillary, perhaps
Not
Eric
Critical
Shipman.
Of Ed Hillary, really, I don't think. He was a bit cavalier.
I guess my question is, were you at all worried about how the mountaineering community would receive your book?
Well, there's different types of mountaineering community, and the Everest mountaineering community was really... The generation that was concerned belonged to the sort of pre-war generation, where you disapprove of training of any kind for sport. It's like Chariots of Fire.
Right.
People ever seen the film Chariots of Fire? Sport should be amateur. Amateur and gentleman were interchangeable. You talked about the stench of professionalism, and amateurism in Olympic sport as well. And it was to make sure, you know, one only had to share a tent with a chap, you know, one got on with. You couldn't expect to go to the mountain with people who are paid to mountaineer. So you kept guides, you barred guides and professional climbers from taking part. And those types of people were still around then.
Okay.
So they loathed the idea of a physiologist getting involved in their climbing Everest, and they wanted to do it without artificial aids altogether. Almost. And so they were pretty nasty on the whole. He had quite a difficult time, but then he was a very difficult man, so if he'd been less difficult, he might have had an easier time.
Sure.
But it was quite... He felt isolated, I think, on the expedition. He felt an awful lot depended on him. But because John Hunt had to accept the policies that had been imposed on him, and John Hunt was a good leader, there was no problem about the policies being implemented.
So your father was clearly instrumental in you know, the success on 53, but he also had influence in other areas of sports science. Could you give us a flavour of the types of things he was involved in afterwards? Because it was more than just Everest, your book.
Well, there's one in this area,
right?
Which is, there was a thing called the Forins Walk. At that time, in the late 50s, early 60s, people didn't understand why people were dying of hypothermia in, you know, in the low hills and the mild climate of the UK, when they could survive near the summit of Everest and in Antarctica. And there was all part of the same amateur sporting tradition. They rather took the view that it was the wrong mental attitudes. People get hypothermia when they have the wrong attitude. They're neurotic. They don't have any determination or guts and that sort of thing. And hypothermia had been studied during the war. It was a terrible killer during the First and Second World War. And they still couldn't have... There was no consensus still about what caused it or how to deal with it.
Yeah.
And they did this walk in the Northern Peak District,
right.
The Forins Walk. And it had been run for 8 years, and then suddenly, 1 year, 1964, there'd never been any mishaps. And then all of a sudden, out of a field of... it was a competitive annual marathon walk for older Boy Scouts, Rover Scouts, sort of late teenage, early 20s. And there were 240, it was competition, 240 entered. And that year... only 22 finished the race, and three boys died and five more were rescued close to death, and it was a national scandal,
of course.
And he, because he'd always been an expert on extreme conditions, he was asked to find out how it had happened. So he came up to the Peak District and he went to the inquests and interviewed competitors that had survived, who had said that it had been the same as all the other years, except for one thing, which was the weather had got a bit bad in the afternoon. And he took the clothes of the dead boys and took them to his laboratory, where there was a wind tunnel, and he made subjects. He tested previously the effect on the insulation value of clothing of wind and of rain had been studied separately, but nobody had thought of studying them together. It's a bit like with the oxygen. Nobody had thought of the obvious thing. And he discovered that in the conditions that they were in, when their clothes got wet in windy weather, they would almost have been better. It was so reduced that they would almost have been better off walking naked.
Yeah,
it was all right for the boys who could go fast enough to keep themselves warm, but for an awful lot of them, they couldn't, so they got hypothermia.
Don't wear jeans, I think, was
it? No, the message was you wear waterproof, windproof, lightweight overgarments.
Right.
And that is still today stopping people. I bet you take that with you when you go walking. You just put them on and keep your clothes dry, and that's his finding. And there are many other findings like that. And then in sport, he got called in with the Mexico Olympics, because people were worried the athletes would die, because there's, can't remember how much less oxygen, but there's quite a lot less oxygen, quarter less, 25% less oxygen, I think. Mexico City, they were being held, and people said it's all wrong holding the Olympics in Mexico City. And so the British Olympic Association called him in to take, they thought athletes would die because they'd overstrained themselves. So he took a team of athletes to Mexico. And
that was Bob Beamon, wasn't it?
That's when he did the long distance.
Bob Beamon.
Because of the air resistance being less.
And he was an extraordinary athlete as well. Presumably.
Yes, he was. But he did the most amazing.
Yeah, I remember that.
Anyway, he discovered that the athletes would run slower, but they wouldn't die. faster in the shorter races and slower in the long races.
Right. So since your the book was published six years ago, what's been different for you as a result of the publication of the book?
I think I was surprised at myself how determined I was that people should know about what he'd done, because even in sports science, where he made quite a lot of original contributions that are quite important, it isn't known, his work isn't known, and I became rather... So I've given quite a lot of talks.
Right.
I'm rather a nervous speaker. I don't...
You don't sound it.
Well... Anyway,
so you've done. Have you been beyond the UK?
Yes, I've given talks in Chamonix, and I went to the Explorers Club in New York.
Right.
And so I've been quite all over a bit, but not that far and wide. But I gave a talk in Verbier. I've just given talks, mostly talks, but that's really all. It hasn't altered my life in any other way. I worry about whether I should write another book and have been trying, but I find it very difficult because it's not got the passion that I had for my...
No, I did read somewhere in a previous interview you were asked what were you working on next, and your response was something like, "I cannot be spoken of before I get permission to do it."
So no, that doesn't sound like...
I was wondering whether there was ever permission. Yeah.
No, I didn't. I was doing something.
Ah, okay.
But I am not really enjoying it, so I don't know what I'm going to do next. But I've still been quite busy doing this, one way or another.
Yeah. And do you think the message is getting out there that Griffith Pugh...
I hope so.
Yeah.
I think so. I think that... I've had very few criticisms of my book, of what I've said in my book.
Yeah.
Most people accept the arguments and think they're properly researched and justified. So I've had very little challenge.
Well, Harriet, it's been great talking to you. I mean, I was the chair of judges for the Borman Tasker in 2013, so obviously I'm a big fan of your book.
I'm sure you've forgotten it by now.
Well, it's one of the few books I've actually read twice, so there are elements of it I do remember, because I know he had an impact on hypothermia in cross-channel swimming as well, so there were other elements of his...
Hypothermia in the water he did first, and then on land. Sorry.
Anyway,
thank you very much for asking me.
Yeah. Thank you, Harriet.
I could see him fiddling. We should have stopped hours ago.